That Chinese Show is a two-hour music and spoken word program.
In our first hour, we will be bringing you a wide selection of Chinese instrumentals and pop music, as well as showcasing a Canadian band each week.
During our second hour, we'll invite famous Chinese doctors to discuss about healthcare and experts to share their opinions on important issues in China.
Tune in to That Chinese Show every Saturday from noon to 2 p.m. on CJSF 90.1 FM.
每周六中午十二点到下午两点，欢迎您收听 CJSF 90.1电台的 That Chinese Show， 家中音乐、中医保健、时事评论。愿 That Chinese Show 伴随您度过难忘时光。
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book Multipliers, How the Best Leaders Make Everyone Smarter by Liz Wiseman, with a foreword by Stephen Covey. Last show, we were looking at the steps required to becoming a liberator. The next step we're going to look at is label your opinions. As you probably already know, formal organizations can create a strong deference to the opinions and thinkings of a leader. One executive described his first week as the newly appointed president of a large company. People came at him from all directions to ask him their pent-up questions. He was new and wanted to be helpful, so he would offer casual opinions. To his amazement, weeks later, he found that his opinions had become a set of disjointed policies.
As he unraveled the mess, he learned to carefully label the difference between a random musing, an opinion, and a policy decision. Try the practice used by Michael Chang in his Shift to Liberator. Divide your views into soft opinions and hard opinions. Definitions. Soft opinions, where you have a perspective to offer and ideas for someone else just to consider, but not to necessarily implement as solid policy implementations. Hard opinions, where you have clear and potentially emphatic points of view that will become policy decisions. By doing so, you can create spaces for others to comfortably disagree with your soft opinions, thinking, and establish their own views. Reserve the right to have hard opinions for when it really matters. Number 3, make your mistakes known. There's no easier way to invite experimentation and learning than to share stories about your own mistakes. As a leader, your acknowledgement of your personal mistakes will give others permission to experience failure and go on to learn and recover with dignity and increased capabilities. Great parents do this with their children. They understand that their children are liberated when they know their parents are human and make mistakes just as they do. They especially appreciate knowing that their parents learned from their blunders and recovered. When we help people see a path to recovery, we spawn a learning cycle. As you share your mistakes, try these two approaches. 1, get personal. Let people know mistakes you have made and what you have learned from them. Let them know how you've incorporated this learning into your decisions and current leadership practices. As a manager of a consulting group, you might share with your team the time you led a project that failed and how you dealt with a livid customer. You can focus on what the experience taught you and how it helped shape your current approach to project management. Secondly, go public. Instead of talking about mistakes behind closed doors or just one-on-one, air them out in the open where the person making the mistake can clear the air and everyone can learn from it. Try making it part of your management ritual. As a corporate manager, I would also take this practice to the extreme. A regular feature in my staff meetings was screw-up of the week. If any member of my management team, including myself, had an embarrassing blunder, this was the time to go public, have a good laugh, and move on. But move on after you've learned something from the blunder. This simple gesture sent a message to the team. Mistakes are an essential part of all creative progress. Each of the above is a simple starting point. But if done consistently over time, these practices can allow a leader to become a powerful force for liberating the intelligence from within an organization. A liberating force. On January 1st, 1831, William Lloyd Garrison, an anti-slavery activist, began a paper called The Liberator, which he published 1,820 issues over 35 years. In The Liberator, Garrison wrote out eloquently and passionately against slavery and for the rights of American blacks and inhabitants. He wrote in the first edition, quote, "I do not wish to think or speak or write with moderation. I am in earnest. I will not equivocate. I will not excuse. I will not retreat a single inch. I will be heard," unquote. Garrison's fervor captures the essence of multipliers. They aren't necessarily social activists like Garrison, but they do activate intelligence. They aren't tyrants, but they can be a bit despotic in their liberation. Multipliers liberate people from intimidation of hierarchical organizations and the domination of tyrannical leaders. They see intelligence around them, and they release it into the organization so it can be freely utilized at the highest point of contribution. They create an environment where ideas can be heard and where intelligence can be given, grown, and stretched to challenge. Next section. The multiplier formula. The tyrant versus the liberator. Summary. Tyrants create a tense environment that suppresses people's thinking and capabilities. As a result, people hold back, bring up safe ideas that the leader agrees with, and works cautiously. Liberators create an intense environment that requires people's best thinking and best work. As a result, people offer their best and boldest thinking and give their best effort. The three practices of the liberator are: 1. Create space. This means release others by restraining yourself, shift the ratio of listening and talking, operate consistently, level the playing field. 2. The liberator demands people's best work. Defend the standard for what defines best work. Distinguish best work from outcomes. 3. Generate rapid learning cycles. Admit and share mistakes. Insist on learning from mistakes. Becoming a liberator. Play your chips. Label your opinions. And make your mistakes well known publicly. Unexpected findings. 1. The path of least resistance is often the path of tyranny. Because many organizations are skewed, a leader can be above average in an organization and still operate as a tyrant. 2. Liberators maintain a duality of giving people permission to think while also creating an obligation for them to do their best work. 3. Multipliers are intense. Leaders who can discern and create the difference between a tense and an intense climate can access significantly more brain power from their organizations. Chapter 4. The Challenger. The number one difference between a Nobel Prize winner and others is not IQ or work ethic, but they ask bigger questions. Peter Drucker. In 2005, Shea Agassi sat in a large auditorium in Davos, Switzerland, at the World Economic Forum. He was there as one of the 200 young global leaders, an elite group of up-and-coming world leaders all under 40 years of age. At the time, he was top executive and board member at SAP and was assumed to be the next in line for CEO. As he sat in the forum, he asked a simple question. Quote, "What could you do to make the world a better place?" Unquote. The question and the challenge struck with him. He left SAP in 2007 and founded Better Place in Palo Alto, California. Shai started with a simple question. How do you run a country without oil? But initially the answers were far from simple. He first posed the questions and tested the ideas with his colleagues at Young Global Leaders and with a white paper to the World Economic Forum. He looked at alternative forms of transportation and worked on the question for 6 months in small groups. After several iterations, he could see opportunity. After a year, he knew pursuing this opportunity was the right thing to do. He began building a team that would make it happen. An idea for a better place. To build his team, he simply explained the opportunity as he saw it. This was nothing short of a chance to make the world a better place, which inspired the name for the company, quote, Better Place, unquote. He then explained the possibility. Known for his sharp intellect and ability to see around corners at what was coming, Shai began to assemble the pieces of the story. He explained the logic supporting electricity as the most viable energy source for cars and took the others through the same logic. Barak Hershkovitz, CTO for A Better Place, said, "After a 5-minute conversation about the opportunity, I decided to leave my job and join him." A challenge. Not only did Shea explain the opportunity he saw, but he began to lay out the challenge. To make electric cars a viable option, someone who would need to build infrastructure for recharging or switching batteries, someone who would need to be the AT&T and build a network across vast geography, After months of analysis, the team realized that battery charging would not be the most viable solution. They would have to build an infrastructure for rapid battery switching at stations like gas stations. Shea issued the challenge to the team and began asking very difficult questions. For example, quote, how can we change a battery in 5 minutes? How can we make it user-friendly, location-independent, car-independent, and cheap so it can be scalable? He turned the problem over to the team and gave them 2 months. The team then broke the challenge down to pieces and constructed a solution. Within 3 months, he had a working prototype, not for a battery switch in 5 minutes, but rather a solution to switch a battery in 1.5 minutes. It was beyond his outrageous expectations. A possibility. Shea is an expert in making the impossible possible, says one senior member of his team. He breaks down the challenge in a way that makes you believe that it can happen. Barak recounts a pivotal moment for A Better Place. Quote, I was preparing for a critical meeting with one of the car makers. I knew that they were skeptical about the solution we had developed, so I had developed a plan B, which was a compromise that might be easier for them to adopt. Right before the critical meeting, I told Shea that I had created, reluctantly, a plan B. Shea asked me, quote, do you believe in what you are doing? He paused. Is this the right solution? He sensed my hesitation and asked, is there a better solution? I told him that there wasn't a better solution. The plan B represented a compromise that would not work well. Shea told me, believe in what you do and stick with the truth. I'll back you up. I stood up at the meeting with the car maker and gave this speech for the original solution, not the plan B compromise. It must have been in the way I said it, with my conviction. But all of a sudden, the impossible became possible. The whole room was now in support of the original solution. Shea is a master at defining opportunities that dare people to stretch beyond what they know how to do. This is one reason why Shea was listed in Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People list, published in a May 2009 issue. His team describes what it's like to work with such a challenge. Quote, he'll outreach all of your capabilities to make it happen. He is highly demanding, but you feel great. You know you are signing up for something that will challenge you on a daily basis for many years to come. You will challenge yourself and all your capabilities. Exhilarating, exhausting, challenging, gratifying. He's a big source of energy. He's a source of power and tailwind for what we do. Shea gets more out of his people than they know they could give. And they love it. It appears the man who seeks to change the world's electric cars has found a way to change the people in his own organization first. Consider now another company founder, The Expert. Richard Palmer founded SNT Systems in the mid-1990s in the United States, the United Kingdom, to build systems and tools for business process reengineering. He started a Richard's Brainchild. The company's intellectual foundation was built on his expertise as a business process analyst and an expert systems. The process reengineering work appealed to Richard's sense of methodology and superior strategy, both developed through years of playing chess as a youth. Not only was Richard one of England's youngest chess champions, holding a master's rating, but it was common knowledge throughout the company that he was a chess champion. It was typically the first thing people said about Richard, chess champion and Oxford University graduate. He was clearly a genius and a chief genius in the company. While he gave the title of CEO to someone else, everyone knew Richard, who remained the chairman of the board, was still the one who called the shots on budget, pricing, products, compensation, and company strategy.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, Instructor of Future Studies at Simon Fraser University. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
With thousands of homeless animals entering SPCA shelters each year, pet overpopulation is a serious problem in BC, but it's one you can help prevent. Spay or neuter your companion animal today. From our perspective, every homeless animal on our streets or in our shelters is one too many. For more information on spaying and neutering initiatives, visit the BC SPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenari, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at the book Multipliers, How the Best Leaders Make Everyone Smarter, by Liz Wiseman, with a foreword by Stephen Covey. We're looking at the section on looking at examples of multipliers. Now we're looking at the challenger and the expert. Specifically, we're looking at Richard Palmer, founded SMT Systems in the mid-1990s. An army of pawns. The energy changes in the room when Richard enters. It is as if the headmasters entered a school assembly. People begin to shrink. People react the way they might when the calculus teacher gives a surprise oral quiz, getting smaller, hoping he or she won't call on them, found them lacking. Despite the fact that everyone fears the attention will turn to them, attention just often stays with Richard, who works to make sure he is seen as an expert and smartest person in the room. In one executive management meeting, Richard put the company general counsel in the hot seat with a pop quiz about a technical distinction on a very specific legal code requiring corporate governance. Richard became concerned that his general counsel didn't fully understand the nuances of this particular code that had to be reported to the city, so he began launching questions. One by one, the general counsel answered them until the questions became more precise and delved into the nuances and obscure scenarios. The general counsel looked puzzled but answered the questions to the best of his knowledge. But that didn't satisfy Richard. Richard left work just in time to stop by the W.H. Smith bookshop before it closed. He didn't buy just any governance book. He bought a 600-page manual on the most recently announced corporate governance codes. And he didn't just look up the answer to the question he asked. He stayed up through the night reading the entire book. The following day, he called a meeting of the executive team. The topic for this emergency management meeting was, of course, this particular code. Richard professed his newfound knowledge and quite publicly let everyone know everything was the general counsel said was wrong. Bad Bishop. Richard is the master of the got you question. Richard only asks questions that he knows the answer to. He asks questions to test other people's knowledge and make sure that other people understand his point of view. One of his vice presidents said, "I can't think of a single time that he has asked the questions when he didn't know the answer." He is also the master of the stall question, which he uses when he doesn't have an answer for himself. He is known for asking frivolous questions during teleconferences to stall the conversation while he googles the answers to get ahead of the conversation. One such stall was during a meeting with an account team that was planning their sales proposal for a deal with British Telecom. The sales team was reviving the proposed contract. Richard, who appeared to not yet know exactly how the contract should be worded, jumped in with, "How many of you have read British Telecom's field operations manual?" The document was 500 pages long and not your typical reading for a sales representative. Wondering if this was a trick question, the team tentatively confessed that they hadn't read it. Richard replied with, "How can you even understand this contract and sell it to a BT if you haven't read the field operations manual?" The sales process came to a complete standstill while the entire account team and Richard, the founder and chairman of the board, read the manual. One team member said, He wasn't the kind of leader that would say, I have an idea. Why don't we look in the manual to better understand the business in terms of the contract? Instead, he made us look ridiculous for not doing it. Fool's mate. It is no surprise that really smart, talented people don't stay long in this organization. Some are asked to leave when the founder finds out that they aren't as smart as he'd like. Others quit and stay, giving up on the idea of making meaningful contributions. The sharpest people leave because they can see the wasted time and talent. They know their organization can't grow beyond that of its founder. Although the company has been able to grow sales under Richard's leadership, most believe that the organization is inherently limited. They remark, we'll never become a serious company. One of these two founders operated as a challenger. The other founder operated as a know-it-all. This chapter is about the difference. The know-it-all versus the challenger. The approach of these two founders captures the essential difference between how the know-it-alls and challengers provide direction, presume opportunities for their organizations. Diminishers operate as know-it-alls, assuming that their job is to know the most and to tell their organization what to do. The organization often revolves around what they know, with people wasting cycles trying to deduce what the boss thinks and how to, at least, look like they are executing accordingly. In the end, diminishers place an artificial limit on what their organization can accomplish. Because they are overly focused on what they know, they limit what their organization can achieve to what themselves know how to do. In setting direction for their organizations, multipliers have a fundamentally different approach. Instead of knowing the answer, they play the role of challenger. They use their smarts to find the right opportunities for their organizations and challenge and stretch their organizations to get there. They aren't limited by what they themselves know. They push their teams beyond their own knowledge and that of the organization. As a result, they create organizations that deeply understand a challenge and have a focus and energy to confront it. The mind of a multiplier. One of the assumptions that lie at the heart of these three is these different approaches to management. Consider our two founders given in the previous examples. What caused Shea to challenge his organization in a way that allowed others to do their very best thinking and to do their best work? And why did other people's intelligence and capabilities stagnate around Richard? We know that both founders are highly intelligent with a clear vision for their organizations and a passion for their work. But if we examine their approach to setting direction, we can distinguish two different logics at work. Deeply embedded in Richard's logic is the assumption, I need to have all the answers. He sees this as the essence of his job as leader, and he doesn't know the answers. He turns to either find them himself or to appear as if he knows the answers when he actually doesn't. What does he do when he doesn't have any answer? He stalls until he can find it. He buys a book on corporate governance. He reads the operations manual. He Googles the answer. He assumes his role is to know and to be an expert, in his assumption that may have been entrenched in the years he studied expert systems. If a leader holds the assumption that it is the leader's role to provide all the answers and to know them, if the employees resign themselves to this mode of business, it's a downward know-it-all spiral that naturally follows. First of all, it is the leader that provides all the answers. Second, subordinates wait for the directives they've come to expect. Third, the subordinates act on the leader's answers. Finally, the leader concludes that they would never have figured this out without me. He or she sees evidence to support this belief and concludes, it is obvious I need to tell others what to do. Shai's leadership at Better Place follows a completely different logic, however. He uses his intellect and energy on.
You're listening to